Governor Andrew Cuomo's resignation this week loomed large over Albany and the rest of the state.
The best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
It's the second time in less than 15 years that a New York governor has resigned amid scandal.
I can and will ask no less of myself. For this reason, I am resigning from the office of governor.
Echoes of former Governor Eliot Spitzer's departure in 2008 still ripple in the halls of the Capitol. The big question right now, of course, is what happens next? And if you want an answer, don't worry, we gotcha. Coming up on this episode of The Eagle, we'll go over the latest on the governor's resignation and the transfer of power to Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul.
And the promise I make to all New Yorkers, right here and right now, I will fight like hell for you every single day.
And we'll take a look back in Times Union history to the days of the Knickerbocker News.
People would describe it as scrappier, had some really good writing.
This is The Eagle, a Times Union podcast, a look inside our newsroom. I'm Jessica Marshall.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome to The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's resignation dominated the headlines this week. The Times Union devoted much of the front page to it, and it's at the top of timesunion.com. In the latest development, we're recording this show on Thursday, mind you, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul told NBC News and the Today Show that at the end of her term replacing Cuomo, she plans to run for governor in 2022. Hochul held a press conference Wednesday, the first time she's spoken publicly since Cuomo announced his resignation.
I am the most prepared person to assume this responsibility, and I'm going to ask the voters at some point for their faith in me again. But right now, I need their faith, I need their prayers, and I need their support to make sure we get this right.
Hochul held a press conference Wednesday, and that's the first time she's spoken publicly since Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his resignation.
I want people to know that I'm ready for this. And it's not something we expected or asked for, but I am fully prepared to assume the responsibilities as the 57th governor of the state of New York.
She said she has yet to assemble her cabinet, but stated explicitly Wednesday that it will not contain any Cuomo staffers accused of unethical behavior.
And I'm going to stand right here. At the end of my term, whenever it ends, no one will ever describe my administration as a toxic work environment.
Hochul will assume office in less than 2 weeks. Now, let's check in with Times Union Editor-in-Chief Casey Seiler and Capitol Bureau Managing Editor Brendan Lyons. They've both been closely following the developments in the last week.
Brendan, thanks a lot for taking the time. It's been a rather busy week. So let's review the events of just the past couple of days, which have been a blur, I would imagine, for both of us and many other people. Specifically, let's go back to Friday and something that the public was not aware of, which was that you and I were here at the Times Union along with a large, or so it seemed to me, CBS news crew. Tell us what that was about.
So, as you know, early last week, when the Attorney General issued their scathing report concluding that Governor Cuomo was a serial sexual harasser, the governor subsequently issued a public statement in which he acknowledged some wrongdoing, attributed a lot of what he had done to misunderstanding and generational and cultural differences. But then he proceeded to attack the credibility of two women. One is Lindsay Boylan, and the other was Brittany Commisso, who at that time was still an anonymous person who had not, she had made her allegations public, but had not done so revealing her identity.
I was afraid that if I had come forward and revealed my name, that the governor and his enablers, I like to call them, would viciously attack me, would smear my name as I had seen and heard them do before to people.
After that occurred with the governor, Ms. Commisso became, you know, very upset about that and had not been pleased that the governor had cast her as a liar, and she wanted him to tell the truth. So CBS News had also expressed an interest in teaming up with the Times Union to interview Ms. Commisso. And the one problem they had was that the Times Union had built a trust from her, has been interviewing her several times since March and April, reported on her story, and in her words, had done so accurately and fairly. So we were sort of a conduit, if you will, with CBS to the alleged victim. It resulted in a three-hour interview at the Hearst Media Center at the Times Union on Friday that took place. And word of that began to get out when CBS had teased that interview a little bit on some social media platforms, and it had an immediate impact in the governor's office as well. On Saturday, I had multiple calls from the chamber, and it was clear they wanted to know, one thing they wanted to know was, would Ms. Commisso be coming out publicly in a sense of revealing her identity or not? They didn't know that, and I think that concerned them. Another concern they had was how far it might go, what might be said in the interview. And so as the weekend wore on, more and more advances, if you will, teases of this interview were being put out.
I am Brittany Commisso. I am a mother. I'm a daughter. I'm a friend. And I'm a human being. I'm a woman. And I have a voice. And now I've decided to use it.
By Monday morning, there was a lot of interest, I think, in hearing this interview. And it was a quite lengthy segment by their standards on CBS Morning News in which Ms. Commisso went public.
I exactly remember looking down, seeing his hand, which is a large hand, thinking to myself, oh my God, this is happening. It happened so quick. He didn't say anything. When I stopped it, he just pulled away and walked away.
We can't say that interview or that you know, the publication of her additional details and such led the governor to resign a day later, but the timing, I think, you know, was part of that tipping point for him.
The timing, I think, was also notable in something that happened Sunday night, which was a pretty brief statement from Melissa DeRosa, the governor's secretary, or, you know, highest aide, effectively kind of chief of staff, that she would be leaving the administration. And that was seen by certainly the most stunning and damaging departure that the governor had sustained since the report came out. Melissa DeRosa's name is all over that report. I think something like mentioned 160 times or more in relation to her defensive efforts, including her organization of the release of material from Lindsay Boylan's personnel file. And that news, I think, fell within the administration and probably fell on the governor like a hammer blow. It was subsequently reported, I believe, by the New York Times that Melissa DeRosa had made that move because she could no longer stand by and defend the governor. And yet, on Tuesday, well, let's now jump ahead to Tuesday. She was there with the governor as he entered the executive chamber's offices in Manhattan to make a statement that was preceded by another presentation from the governor's attorney, Rita Glavin, who took part in a rather ill-starred, I think it's fair to say, Zoom call on Friday, offering up some of the defense. And then on Tuesday, she came and offered it again, which turned out to be a prologue to the governor's appearance.
The report, as I've said before, contains errors, and it omits key evidence. It omitted evidence that undermined the narrative that began in day one on this investigation.
And to Rita Glavin's credit, I will say that she's pointed out some glaring deficiencies in the Attorney General's report and errors, because Ms. Commisso had told them that the November 16th day at the mansion last year, when it was a very busy day, the governor's schedule was literally minute to minute. They could document calls with the Michigan governor, calls with this person. And it was many people in the mansion that day, his family, Melissa DeRosa, other senior aides. It was a day when it could not have happened, the groping incident, as she described, which was on a day when the mansion was quite empty other than the staff and the state police. And she had been dispatched to help him with a matter on his iPhone, which I would note, too, that you recall our conversation with Melissa DeRosa and other that got a lot of attention. That was about the fact that who would dispatch her to the mansion for that. They never denied that Ms. Camisso or other young female aides would be sent to the mansion or into his office to assist him with technical matters on his cell phone. But the point is that she had said that the November 16th date was something that she could pin her memory to, that it happened around that time, that it was sometime in November, but not that date. But the Attorney General's report says it did happen on that day. And they have not walked that back. They won't correct the error and have instead pointed to this equally confusing footnote that does indicate that she said it was around that time, but not that day. So I can understand the governor's frustration as well as Ms. Glavin's, but they've also cited our stories, which have made note of the fact that Ms. Camisso thought it was later in the month, possibly around Thanksgiving week, that she was dispatched. And that might also explain why the mansion was more quiet on the day that she went there, because it was a holiday week.
So after Rita Glavin is done giving this presentation, the governor appears. Once again, this is just a live video statement. It's not there are no reporters in the room, or at least not that we know of. And he begins to echo many of the points in her defense that the AG's investigation was unfair. And then comes a pivot in the statement. And then the governor announces, and I think it stunned everybody virtually who was watching it, that he was going to step down effective in 2 weeks. And Brendan, I just ask you, I mean, what was your reaction as you were watching that?
I was shocked because I thought they were laying the groundwork for Armageddon, for battle in the impeachment, that they were going to make their case. And then his shift happened during the speech. And I was shocked. I didn't see it coming. And then it was, you know, the moment for me was he choked up for a second. He seemed to just swallow slightly, and his eyes, you could see it in his eyes.
It is a matter of life and death, government operations. And wasting energy on distractions is the last thing that state government should be doing. And I cannot be the cause of that.
And that was when, you remember, I put on our Slack channel in the newsroom, Cuomo resigns. Because even before he got the rest of the words out, it just seemed that you knew, oh my gosh, there was something subtle there. He's done. And then, yeah, he shifted.
New York tough means New York loving. And I love New York. And I love you. And everything I have ever done has been motivated by that love. And I would never want to be unhelpful in any way. And I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
I think that for him, he did apologize. He did admit to some behavior, but he never really accepted enough responsibility for some. He certainly was affected by the trooper and by Charlotte Bennett. But the others, he wanted to dismiss them as not believable. And that fell flat with a number of people, you know, a number of observers and lawmakers who really believe that he should have acknowledged all of it, period.
And so now let's look ahead. Lieutenant Governor, soon to be Governor Hochul, has to take the reins of a huge and complex state bureaucracy. So I guess the two big questions would be, what is next for Kathy Hochul, and what is next for Andrew Cuomo, especially in terms of the ongoing impeachment effort, which has to begin in the Assembly, of course, with the Assembly Judiciary Committee, and in terms of any criminal peril that he is still facing.
He's got four battles still going on. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn in the Eastern District is still in the throes of an investigation of the governor's handling of nursing homes, possibly of his arranging for preferential coronavirus testing for his relatives as well, including Chris Cuomo. The Albany County District Attorney's Office and several other district attorneys, including in Manhattan and on Long Island, are also getting access to the Attorney General's files and have investigations into some of the conduct that has been described by the women to determine whether or not there could be criminal exposure for the governor there. And then the Attorney General also has still an investigation that was separate from the sexual harassment matter that is focused on whether the governor misused state resources when employees were tasked and, as he said, volunteered to help him with his $5 million book on his handling of the pandemic. The impeachment proceeding is going to be more interesting because already there are scholars, constitutional scholars, who are saying that because Cuomo resigned, he cannot be impeached. But because they have invested millions of dollars in this effort, and they had other things they were looking at in addition to sexual harassment, members of the assembly have indicated that they may still move forward, but with something that might culminate in a report similar to what the Attorney General had issued, so that they can affirm or possibly buttress what the Attorney General had found.
And what about Kathy Hochul? You know, there's no instruction manual for state government, although, of course, I guess David Paterson found himself in the same situation back in 2008 after Eliot Spitzer stepped down. And obviously, this has been a potential outcome that Kathy Hochul has been living with, contemplating for the better part of, what, 7-8 months now since these scandals began swirling around the governor?
Sure. So she's certainly regarded as a capable leader and lawmaker. And this 14-day handoff, if you will, between governor's announcement and when he officially resigns, I think makes sense. I think that the transition is a little more complicated in the handing off of this power base because we're in the middle of a pandemic. Although the state of emergency is over for the coronavirus, there is still a pandemic, and it's making a comeback in some fashion. You also have the eviction issue that has been a really slow rollout for the state. They are stumbling on this, and that affects many people who may be facing eviction and not getting the funds that have been promised to be delivered by the federal government because New York was put in charge of that and has stumbled greatly. And in addition to that, in the backdrop of all this is the incredible spike in gun violence and homicides and shootings that prompted Cuomo to declare a state of emergency. But what will be interesting to see is if the progressive wing of the party or others begin sort of an effort to undermine Hochul to, you know, begin circulating information about her to try to damage any potential run for governor that she may want to make. She reminds me a lot, May, of you, of being in the same shoes as David Paterson when Eliot Spitzer fell from grace.
Brendan, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. And of course, thanks for all the good work.
You bet.
For more on the developments in Albany, check out our Capital Confidential section of timesunion.com. After the break, we will go back in time to the heyday of the Knickerbocker News.
Hi, I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. Join us for an ongoing discussion on major developments in the saga of Keith Raniere, co-founder of Nexium, the shadowy upstate New York organization at the center of the explosive federal investigation that resulted in Raniere's conviction on charges of extortion, sex trafficking, and more. We talk to former members of Nexium, discuss the latest news, and preview the likely next twists in this bizarre and disturbing story. You can find Nexium on Trial at timesunion.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm Jessica Marshall. We've got exciting news here at Times Union HQ. We launched a new free afternoon e-newsletter this week. If you sign up for it, you'll get the latest headlines delivered straight to your inbox around 3 p.m. every day. That's just in time to get a news fix during your afternoon coffee break. We're calling it The Nick. Now, if that name sounds familiar to you, you are not imagining it. It's an homage to the Knickerbocker News, an historic paper that we used to print. On September 4th, 1843, Irish-American journalist-turned-publisher Hugh Hastings published the first edition. He called it the Albany Knickerbocker. Its name was a nod to the capital city's Dutch heritage. And for those who don't know, the Dutch settlers who came to the capital region were known to wear distinctive short pants called knickerbockers. It was an evening paper. It even grew to become the region's top newspaper for a time. In 1847, a correspondent for the Nick was thought to have transmitted the first ever news dispatch from New York to Albany via telegraph. It was a speech by then President John Tyler.
People didn't have, they had radio, but they really didn't have TV to watch. They didn't, it wasn't in the lifestyle to come home and go out, play tennis, or do a lot of extracurricular activities. And a lot of people worked early mornings and were home at 2-3 in the afternoon. So delivering an afternoon newspaper with up-to-date news was very popular and lucrative.
That's Mike Spain, a retired Times Union news editor who started at the Nick in 1978. He wrote for it until it folded into the TU 10 years later. But let's go back. The Gannett Corporation bought the Nick in 1928. By that time, it had become a formidable rival to the Times Union.
In the 1950s, after World War II, more and more people were working office jobs. People had more money. They were doing more extra things, and television came along, and afternoon newspapers began to suffer. But it was still very competitive. And by the time 1960 rolled around, both the Knickerbocker News and the Times Union were like right at it with each other. And they were both kind of losing money trying to beat the other guy.
In 1960, according to legend, a fateful coin toss entwined the fates of the Knickerbocker News and the Times Union. Gannett and the Hearst Corporation, which owns the TU, made a deal to swap ownership of papers that they owned in Albany and Rochester. Hearst gained the Nick for a cool $3.85 million, according to the New York Times. Hearst continued to operate the Nick alongside the Times Union for another 28 years. Its circulation peaked in the early 1970s at just over 70,000.
Well, it was smaller by the time I got there in 1978. People would describe it as scrappier. It had some really good writing. It had some notable names, like there was a fellow who covered state capital who came from Gannett when the Nick was owned by Gannett, named Arvis Chalmers, who many people may not know around the state capital now, but he was like the dean of capital correspondence, and people would come to him and bring him stories. He just had to, you know, puff on his cigar, and people would walk through the door of his little office at the Capitol, and he'd be way ahead of things.
Washington Post alum Harry Rosenfeld, fresh from exposing the Watergate scandal, took the helm of both the Times Union and the Nick in 1978.
It just was a nice alternative to a more hard-driven, morning-type newspaper. Afternoon newspapers had the challenge by the 70s and 80s to kind of put another spin on the news, to kind of do analytical news almost instantly. So if, you know, you went and covered a meeting and the town board did this, the morning paper would say, boom, 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 it did this, this, this. The afternoon paper might have to say that, but they have to tell the story. Because of what happened last night, Larry Jones can now, you know, expand his cornfield and grow, you know, blah, 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 because he got a permit. You know, you needed to kind of put it in perspective and make it into a yarn and tell a story.
Mike Spain covered the Albany suburb of Colony during his time at the Nick.
There was a reporter for the Schenectady Gazette. There was a reporter for the Record in Troy. But there was a reporter covering Colony from the Times Union, a really good reporter named Ronald Kermani. I regarded him as my number one competitor. And if I could beat him, break a story on the beat and embarrass him, it was very difficult to do it. I didn't do it very often. that was what I wanted to do. We really regarded it as our fierce competitor, and we were very careful not to tip our hands, even though we were in the same building, although we were on different sides of the first floor.
Mike Spain remembers big stories that the Nick covered during his decade there. In that span, it covered the deaths of Governor Nelson Rockefeller, longtime Albany Mayor Erastus Corning II, the rise of Mario Cuomo to governor and to national political figure. And it wasn't just politics that made it special, though, he recalls.
They were an early pioneer on doing environmental stories. You know, they covered the Hudson River pollution, and they covered the, you know, just the general topic of the environment before it had broken out as kind of a specialty beat now that newspapers and media and websites all devote a lot of resource to, because we see what's happening. But it was also known for great editorial writing. It had really good food coverage and, you know, feature coverage.
By 1988, the market for an afternoon paper was waning. Circulation had dropped to below 30,000. Hearst made the decision to combine the papers. Mike Spain remembers when that happened.
I was at the Knickerbocker News, and I was disappointed that they combined it into one called the Times Union. But that was the bigger of the two newspapers. Everybody on the staff of the Knickerbocker News went over to the Times Union, and it was phenomenal. We had like 183 people in the newsroom. Harry Rosenfeld, the late Harry Rosenfeld, great editor, took command of the single newspaper. He had been there since 1978, leading both papers, and he was now in charge of this big, extra big paper. We had extra coverage in the state capitol. We had a couple of reporters covering every town. We really were equipped to thoroughly cover the news.
Today, the Times Union has a smaller but robust newsroom. The digital age has brought about a 24-hour news cycle and mobile access to news anytime, anywhere, on timesunion.com or through social media. It's really a different world than it was in the heyday of evening papers. But the spirit of the Nick lives on.
Yeah, the Nick was, you know, it was good storytelling. It knew it had to tell a story, because by the morning, after the morning papers, people knew what happened. Now they had to know what the story behind the story was.
The final edition of the Knickerbocker News was published on Friday evening, April 15th, 1988. On the front page, splashed in bold caps, "We say farewell." Beneath it, 145 years of publishing began with Irish Immigrant and $7.50. Photos of the paper and people from different periods in history dot the page above and below the fold. A lone copy of this final paper, yellowed but still crisp, sits in a news rack in the Times Union newsroom. A reminder of days gone by, a record of journalism history. All right, that's it for this week. I'm Jessica Marshall. We'll be back next week with another look inside the newsroom here at the Times Union. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, or head over to timesunion.com for the latest news and features. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by me, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Casey Seiler, Brendan Lyons, and Mike Spain for their reporting and contribution to this episode.